JEA says utility rates are going to spike in the next decade. Tenants at the Jacksonville Landing prepare to move out. And a school tax proposal goes before the city council. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning. We're live from Studio 5, and this is First Coast Connect. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, we've got all the top stories of the week with our Friday roundtable. You can get on the line now and join us. It's 549-2937. Give us a call. Then later, renowned cellist Dave Egger performs live in studio. You won't want to miss that. All of that ahead. But first, it's Friday, and we've got a very busy week in the news to go over as we welcome David Bauerlein of the Florida Times Union. Hey, David.
Good morning.
Giorgio Valentino, editor of Folio Weekly, is here.
Hello.
Stephanie Brown, assistant news director and reporter at WOKV.
Good morning.
And our own regular contributor, Charles Griggs.
Good morning.
Guys, so good to have you and lots to talk about this week. Everything from the final tenants at the Jack's Landing picking up stakes to a half-cent sales tax proposal for local schools. That's now in the fate of the city council. We'll talk about it all. But our top story right now, JEA customers face the potential for steep double-digit increases in electric and water rates over the next 10 years. That's unless the utility changes its business model. Now, our partner, the Florida Times Union, reports that the base rate for electric bills would increase by 52% over the next decade. JEA says it could hold the increase to 40% if the utility stops making annual contributions to City Hall. But that, of course, would blow a huge hole in the city budget. So we're going to begin the hour with a closer look at this. What do you think about the prospect of your utility rates going up by as much as 50%? What do you think the solution is as Jacksonville transitions painfully to cleaner energy sources over time? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org and tweets to @MelissaInJax. All right, let's begin with you, David Bauerlein. You reported this story. JEA got a really bleak forecast. Its board of directors did the other day. What were they told?
Well, they were basically told that if you look over the next 10 years, they're going to continue to see a reduction in the amount of electricity that's sold. That could be a good thing, right? Because people are becoming more energy efficient. Homes are getting better suited to consume less electricity. But in terms of the revenue, the days of yore where JEA could just pencil in 3% annual increase in their revenue, that's not happening anymore. And meanwhile, their costs are going to go up. They're going to start absorbing the cost of their participation in this Plant Vogtle nuclear plant, which is going to come online in the next 2 or 3 years in Georgia. So there's this combination of factors at work. So they look at this chart basically showing, you know, their revenue's not going to be going up, up, up. Their expenses are still going up and the lines cross, and that's a bad position to be in if you're a utility. Having said all this, this is what their scenario is, kind of under status quo, nothing changes. The next step is they're going to do, say, what can we do within our current authority to make things better? And then the third step would be, okay, what changes, if any, do we need in the city charter to free us to be able to do other things that could sort of put the situation in a better light?
Wow. Okay. There's a lot to go over there. Giorgio Valentino, what about the cynical take on this, which is that this is JEA laying the groundwork to perhaps open up the discussion again of privatizing the utility?
It does seem that like that's what's going on. And there's a lot of folks that for ideological reasons will buy into that, of course, not realizing that privatization is not going to change any of these costs. In fact, what it's going to do, taxpayers still going to be paying all of the expenses. It's just the profits are going to be privatized. That's all that's going to change. It's not going to be like comparison shopping for toothpaste brands.
No, not at all. You know, Stephanie Brown, utilities all over the country are grappling with this. In fact, as David reported in his story, in less than 10 years, the average electric and water customer can look at these numbers and say, over time, it's just cheaper for me to go off the grid, put solar panels on my roof, get battery generating storage power in my house. I can do it for less money than going through the utility. And JEA is going to have to face that reality.
What we saw in this presentation from the JEA senior leadership is that this is in response to a lot of industry pressure. As you just mentioned, there are changes that are being made in how energy is provided. There's more competition and different types of competition that they never necessarily expected just a few years ago that they would really be facing. So you are in this position where something that may be a little bit good for a consumer, like a higher degree of energy independence, the ability to convert their own solar, that does mean less revenue for JEA. But to David's point, you know, this is the starting point for needing to look at what will change. We know JEA has been investing in solar. They were very blatant in saying they've had some ventures to try to diversify that haven't worked. So now is the time where they're at the table to try to look at what other ventures they can tackle, what other steps they can be taking so that this does not become a reality.
Yeah. And Charles, as Stephanie said, JEA is building solar farms, a handful of them, not as much as solar advocates would like to see. They're putting up a new corporate headquarters and a new location downtown. But for the average consumer out there, people listening to this, what people need to understand is that our rates could go up significantly for a lot of customers out there, painfully.
So when you have this type of presentation and you alert the public that we see these types of problems on the horizon, what people also want to know, from what I've been hearing, is that what type of innovations are you planning on implementing in order to mitigate some of these issues and some of these problems? This isn't anything that we didn't already know. I mean, they've been facing these types of challenges for some time now. And so to put numbers on it at this time, people, like you mentioned earlier, some cynics would say, what is the timing of all of this? And if you're going to roll out this type of information, you could sort of satisfy some of the public's fears by saying, here's some of the things that we're considering going forward that may be positive for the marketplace here in Duval County versus some of the things that that seem very drastic, like eliminating the city's contribution.
Yeah, let me ask you, David Bauerlein, about this. You know, as Charles just pointed out, JEA doesn't pay property taxes, which negatively impacts the local school system. We'll talk about that in a moment. It pays that annual contribution into the city general fund. They would be paying about $60 million in property taxes if they were paying property taxes. Instead, they pay about $115 million a year in the form of an annual contribution. And so what are your thoughts about the speculation some have raised that as JEA looks at this painful financial future, they are teeing up the privatization discussion once again? That could give Jacksonville billions in the short term, but we lose that annual contribution in the long term.
It's possible. You know, it's possible. I mean, the where it was left last year was there was this report that came out of the city council that said, there are all these pressures. JEA needs to go out and find some other revenue sources. So at least what they're doing right now is just that. They are saying, let's see if we can find some other revenue sources. Certainly, if you are interested in privatizing JEA, you can look at these and say, well, this could be ammunition for making the case for doing that. The one thing that I've heard so far that they've talked about as far as JEA finding another line of business is, the biggest single impact on their revenue has been energy efficiency. People are doing a lot more to save electricity. Well, if that market is hurting JEA, then JEA might say, let's get in that market. So maybe they start doing rooftop solar installations. Maybe they start selling energy efficient products.
And which is,
well, that's a public entity getting into the private marketplace. There's a lot of issues involved with that.
Yeah.
Which Charles. Is interesting because that's what JEA has been very good about, advocating for energy efficiency in the community. They've been one of the things
they'll
they've
come
done
out and do an energy audit at your house.
They do a great job at that. So they're pretty much putting themselves out of business in that capacity. But like David said, maybe one of the avenues could be to figure out a way to get in on the business that they're actually good at, it is energy efficiency.
Giorgio.
Yeah, and that's fine. There are ways to improve the system within the structure of public ownership. A lot of folks just dump, they hear public ownership, they think everything has to stay the same way. And I would contend that reform is, a better form of reform is possible with public ownership and accountability versus privatization.
All of the questions that were raised during privatization, fundamentally not a lot of change over the concerns then. You know, you still have the hurricane response and the input of the government. All of those don't change just because of what comes out here. And again, these are industry pressures that are causing this problem. So that's not to say that the private energy companies may not be experiencing to a substantial degree what JEA is talking about as well. The difference is JEA is talking about this publicly, whereas other companies may not do the same thing.
Yeah, I think one of the interesting parts of this conversation is that, you know, JEA is a public utility, and we see in which we'll be talking about later with the school district, where they're asking for additional funding, tax increase to do some things, the facilities. People are asking for internal efficiencies, you know, how to figure out how to make the organization run more efficient. What we're talking about with JEA has been more energy efficiency, but I don't think anyone is talking about how to make the organization run smoother or more efficiently internally in order to save money that way. And it's almost like the conversation has not used the same language per se when we're looking at those types of economic impacts to the community.
Well, and when you listen, to the presentation, they did spend some time talking about how they've tried to right size. We know, for example, with that headquarters building, part of the reason is looking for a building that is more appropriate for the size of their workforce and more efficient to run. They have cut down their workforce over the last few years, but it's kind of we're almost at a critical point where there aren't maybe many more traditional efficiencies to find where you can reduce that workforce more. So now it becomes, what are those non-traditional ways?
Yeah, all great points and lots of calls. Meanwhile, here on our Friday Media Roundtable, what are your thoughts about a potentially huge spike in JEA bills over the next decade? As we talk about this, we want to hear from you. It's 549-2937. Scott is on the north side. Hi, Scott. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing to everyone? The first thing I am concerned about, let's talk about an audit here with the school board, with JTA, all these entities to find out where is the money. I agree with Gray. He's 100% correct that there's a lot of other things that's going on with JEA that can decrease the cost of JEA, I'm sorry, I apologize for that.
That's okay. And yeah, thanks for that call. Appreciate the call. Let's go to Jordan in Springfield. Hi, Jordan, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. My comment was I definitely understand that there's a lot of strategic issues that JEA has to face, and, you know, between clean energy transition and public versus private. To me, the rate increase alone doesn't seem like a huge issue. I know you described it as a huge spike, but if I heard you correctly at the beginning, it's projected to be about 50% over 10 years. If you annualize that, that's only about 4.1%, which doesn't seem crazy to me, given all of the competitive pressures and cost pressures that go into that. Am I thinking about that accurately?
Yeah, thanks, Jordan, for that question. David, if this is phased in over time, would it be less painful for people?
And maybe you wouldn't notice it as much. There's no rate increase next year, for example. But I can see if you're a industry that's considering Jacksonville as a location to relocate or expand, if you look and say, okay, I know that over the next 10 years, my base rate, which just is a portion of the overall electric rate you're paying, is going to go up by 52%. You're going to go, well, that's a cost that I'm going to have to absorb, and I'm going to look someplace else. And I think it's a factor.
It needs to be comparable to your regular cost of living increases across time. So if you're thinking about it in terms of how much rent or my mortgage payment would be over a 10-year period, you'd want it to be consistent with that as well.
And another thing, I don't think we should live our lives thinking about how our behavior is going to attract potential investors in the future. I mean, we're supposed to be serving our citizens and taxpayers right now.
And it's serving the citizens. I believe they equated it to a few hundred dollars on the average residential. Mm-hmm. And while many people may be able to absorb that, there's a substantial portion of this community that a few hundred dollars more each year is a big deal. You know, so yeah. JEA doesn't want to be leaving out that portion of their customer base.
Let me ask you, David Bauerlein, how does JEA compare to other city-owned utilities around the country in terms of how they're dealing with all these pressures on utilities? How are other city-owned utilities handling it?
I think that JEA is probably out front in terms of sort of looking at costing out what these changes are going to be. You know, there's other, the deal with city-owned utilities is the history seems to be they look at privatizing and they always end up not doing it. So I don't think that any other utility is doing the kind of analysis that JEA is doing that I'm aware of. So that's a difference. You know, as far as looking to privatize, I think JEA was one of the only places that I saw in the whole country that was talking about privatization last year.
And it's, so it's the unusual. Eighth largest community-owned utility in the country, isn't that correct?
That's right.
One of the biggest, not the biggest. It gives us a benchmark to look at least.
Which makes the fact that it's a publicly-owned utility even more vital, because the community can keep the pressure on and make sure it runs efficiently, unlike what you would have if you were a private organization.
Let's go to Bobby on the north side. Bob, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. I know we're getting a lot of efficiencies in the way we build houses and people using their own solar power, but the crux of this is that JEA and whoever the utility is has to maintain a grid to back up your home. Say we have, you know, a hurricane come and it doesn't, you know, sun doesn't shine for 3 or 4 days and your solar power is not working. You know, JEA has to maintain that grid that you switch to. So, yes, in a time of declining revenue, that can be an issue. But I think JEA is probably one of the most proactive and most efficiently run organizations out there, because I deal with other utilities and I think their rates are comparable.
Thanks for that. Here's a tweet from a listener. Let's not forget JEA is a nonprofit. It shouldn't be run like a for-profit business. It exists for the benefit of the community. They should be aggressively pushing energy efficiency and clean energy. There is no winning in dragging their feet. What about that?
Well, the caller who talked about the solar energy, that is the issue right now, which is you can put solar panels on your house, and that's great for the homeowner. But then when the sun doesn't shine, they still want electricity.
Sure.
So JEA is the backup power source. The big change coming is that these improvements in battery technology means you can have a solar panels on your house. And then when the sun's shining, you store the energy.
Didn't you report that in under a decade, it will be more cost effective for the average homeowner that can afford it to do that rather than get their energy through the utility?
JEA is saying in the mid-2020s, that's when they expect that change will happen.
That's not far away.
Not at all.
Jim is in Riverside. Hi, Jim. Good morning. Go ahead.
Yes, good morning. I wanted to say that if JEA wanted to find a new revenue stream that is possible to send broadband through the power lines, and they could put JEA customers on broadband, and that way people with low credit scores could still get Wi-Fi in their homes, and that would be a new revenue stream for JEA.
Hmm. Thanks for that. That's interesting.
Because maybe having some problems getting through regulations to make that happen. Because I can see the cable industry going, not in my backyard. You know, so
here's an email from Joe. What is the comparison in rates with FPL to JEA? In other words, do investor-owned, privately-owned utilities charge more?
JEA is a little bit higher than FPL, but not a huge amount.
It depends
higher
on the market, though.
So, right. Yeah.
Okay, and here's another tweet. How many JEA board members are subject matter experts in the areas of energy generation and distribution?
Well, what we have here is not, this is not a board initiative, so to speak. So the board is responsible for giving influence and guiding and, you know, setting the standards. But the senior leadership team and the people on the ground at JEA, they're the ones who have been spending the last, I think they said 6 months or so, if not more, trying to put together this presentation. And they're the ones who are ultimately looking at what comes next. So it will fall to the board to, you know, have influence over what JEA does ultimately pursue. But what's coming in front of them is going to be something that's been researched and put together from those subject matter experts.
It's not often common practice for board members to be subject matter experts across the board. They typically are people who understand how business models work. And the, like Stephanie mentioned, the staff is the one, they're the ones available to make their case for what should be, how the board should move. So it's not necessarily, you know, that important for everybody to be subject matter experts on the board.
And if you're just tuning in, it's our Friday Media Roundtable with Stephanie Brown, Charles Griggs, David Barreline, and Giorgio Valentino, and myself as we talk about the biggest headlines from the week. Right now, we're going to shift gears and talk for a minute about the fate of those final tenants hanging on at the Jacksonville Landing. They are preparing to leave the property for the last time. Now, the deadline for short-term leaseholders to vacate the landing was technically 5 o'clock today. But the city says they're getting a little extra time. The city's setting aside some funds for tenant relocation assistance. Give us a call, and if you're a tenant at the landing listening to this, give us a call. It's 549-2937. And so those final tenants, Finn McCool's, Hooters, a bank, you know, there are still a few businesses located at the landing, David Bauerlein, but they've got to move out forthwith as demolition plans, despite the controversy, move ahead.
Right. I walked through the landing yesterday, and I think there were 3 or 4 tenants there. It was crazy. I walked in, and there was a line of about 30 or 40 people at the Coastal Cookies stand. Aww. And so the word is out today. If you want to get Coastal Cookies,
your last chance.
This is your last chance today, because after today, the closest location is in Texas.
Wow.
So there's a little bit of nostalgia going. People are going there just to be able to get their last bite. Now, Hooters, I think, is not closing today. They're going to be there for some period of time. But just about everybody else is closed. So as a mall, after today, it's not going to be a mall anymore. You can go there to a bank, and you can go there to Hooters. But the idea is kind of walking around and getting something from here and something from there. That ends after today.
Right. And, you know, there was a spirited outcry from those opposed to raising this structure. That argument didn't sway the mayor's office or city council. They voted to move ahead with raising the space and putting up given to understand a combination of green space and some new structure, some bit of retail to replace the landing. And so, you know, as the tenants try to figure out where they're going to go, you know, it's really the end of an era for the city of Jacksonville in more ways than one, Stephanie.
And the business, unfortunately, started to realize that when the city provided them, you know, other downtown locations, where might you be able to move? And they realized the rent at some of those places was substantially higher than what they were dealing with. A lot of these tenants were on month-to-month leases, not necessarily something you're going to find in a new business arrangement. So for the people who had been established there for decades, it's definitely a hard pill to swallow. And I don't think you're ever really going to hear the end to the outcry from, you know, those who want to preserve that structure. But, you know, the plans that are put forward, we know they want, the city wants more river access and river view. They want more park space, and they don't want all of the liability that comes with leaving that building vacant for any substantial period of time.
Yeah. As you pointed out, the owner, Tony Slayman, did allow those tenants to pay greatly reduced rent and go month to month. That was something that was known for years. We can talk about the business model he created around that. Mm-hmm. But the reality is, due to a long and fraught history that he had with the city, he wasn't able to work out a deal to repurpose that structure.
Yeah, and he saw that coming, because the last time he orchestrated leases with the tenants, they had the 30-day buyout clause in there, which puts them in a position now where they have to go. And it's unfortunate, but this is pretty much what they signed up for. And because they were operating under a scenario where they were paying below market value in most cases, it puts them in a tough position, because they're not able to find comparable space downtown in the downtown area. It's going to be very difficult for them to do that. And that is why the people who remain are still there, and the people who haven't packed up and kind of done some a storage type situation are still in limbo, because it's going to be very difficult. And really, the city is just doing a business deal. And I think that the folks, when they saw the deal close on the landing, they had to prepare themselves to be gone, because, you know, with the clause in the lease, they had to go.
And to that point, that's why, you know, there's been some level of chatter and concern. Why is Hooters getting this big payout? Why is Finn McCool's getting this big payout? That's in their leases. They had those buyout terms. They were committed to being in that structure beyond a month-to-month term. So it's not that the city favored these two establishments. They did make renovations, and, you know, there's some compensation for that. But it's not a special favor. It's that contractually, this was an obligation.
Georgia.
And let's not forget, this whole thing is not just a business deal. It's also, it's a political move. I mean, it happened during the election cycle, and downtown development as a subject is something that's highly political here. So first of all, it's a raw deal for the tenants there. I get that. It's nostalgic for folks who grew up around there. I get that. I can only enjoy it from afar because I'm a newcomer. But what I see is just this cynical political move, and the way that it's unfolding is so opaque and just so transparently political is just
astounding.
You
talking about the narrative that's formed, which is that in demolishing the landing, this potentially creates an opportunity for the city to do a land swap whereby they take the park space that's located at the former Metropolitan Park, which they're not allowed to develop on because it's green space. They transfer the green space over to the site of where the landing is about to be demolished. And that then clears the way for Shad Khan and related players to develop around the stadium, which he's aggressively planning to do, including developing on the site of the former Metropolitan Park. All of the power players involved in this want to, it seems, shift all the momentum east of the landing over to the sports complex and let the development proceed over here where we're sitting at WJCT Studios. Metropolitan Park is right next door to our building. And so we're watching this closely, too. What about now when you say that the politics of that are opaque, that nobody has come out and said that's what's happening. But certainly when you talk to people in the real estate field and people who have connections at City Hall, this is what we're hearing. This is what seems to be taking shape.
Let me also add that space, formerly the landing, is going to become a parking area, a pen for homeless folks. So that's also going
to
happen.
Well, let's just say it is a political move to, you know, to sort of move everything east, and the powers that be are orchestrating this piece. No one has done anything in the meantime to counter that. I mean, so if people are moving at the political will of the community, which they believe they are, then no one has stepped up to do anything about that. No one has offered or, you know, implied or tried to plan or strategize for something different. So if
a public outcry qualifies as, you know.
Well, there was a fair bit of outcry. There was one incoming city council member, Matt Carlucci, who's spoken out against this. He's not on the city council yet. Other than that, you're right. There, no one in officialdom has departed from the party line.
An outcry doesn't really qualify as something that moves the public politically to action. And I think those people who are, as you say, Georgia, politically motivated to do so are doing just that. They're moving, you know, taking the necessary steps, whatever those political steps are, to gain the support they need to get in order to take these actions.
Okay, now it looks like we have a tenant on the line from the landing. It's Edwin. Edwin, are you calling from Mandarin? Edwin, good morning. You're on the air.
Hey. Hi. Yeah, I'm the president of the Art Center Cooperative. We've had art galleries downtown for about 15 years, but we've been in the landing for the last 4 years. And I think for us, it's the meanness and the aggressive nature of the city that's been amazing. We got the 30-day notice, but the weekend before was Jazz Fest and the Memorial Day weekend, and very difficult to move out. So we asked them for an extension. They said, no, you can't have one. And then, so we made preparation. Then Wednesday, they got a hold of us and said, yes, you can, now we'll give you this agreement that you can sign. Here's the extension, for another week. But by signing that, all that they promised in relocation expense was a refunding of your May's rent. And no other, and it indemnifies them from going after any more compensation after that. We had a meeting 2 weeks ago with Councilman Gaffney, who came down and met with the tenants. And told us that he was going to try and get an extension and try and get some relocation funding. So as of yesterday, none of the tenants was going to sign the what they call the holdover agreement, because it would limit our possible relocation expense, and we're going to rely on the councilman to help us get some funding.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that. Let me ask you, and I know this is tough for you and the other tenants, what are your plans now once you get through this matter with the city? What are you going to do? Where are you going to go?
Well, from the day the buyout was announced, I mean, we've been looking for years. We know that we were below market value, and the fact was that the packet that was sent to us by DIA was average rents were about 10 times what we were paying at the Landing. So it's taken some time, and right now the place that we have a letter of intent for a lease on is at the Regency on the east side, right near Penny's, where...
At the Regency Mall.
At the Regency Mall, because they're trying to do some revitalization. As you know, they just brought four food trucks in to filled up the food court again, and there are some other art groups that are trying to look at expanding in there. One of the things that was fortunate for us, we also have a second location on East Union Street where we rent out studios, and that became our storage facility.
Huh.
So we're taking all this stuff from the Landing out there.
Okay.
Waiting for the lease to be signed.
Well, listen, I so appreciate you calling in and sharing your perspective and your plans with us. It gives all of the listeners and all of us here in the studio a better idea of how this is affecting you and some of your fellow tenants. So, Edwin, thanks for that call. Thanks for the call this morning.
All right.
Okay. So, yeah. So, there you go. And interesting to hear that he's moving over to the Regency Mall, which has had its own struggles.
Yeah. And it's fairly obvious that the city is trying to, you know, clear the tenants out so they can get this, you know, the space cleared so they can get it demolished in a timely manner. So whatever is supposed to happen next can happen. And I guess we'll find out what that is at some point in the future. But, you know, there's a reason why, you know, people are being pressured to move forward expeditiously.
Okay. And we need to move on and talk about another big item from the week. Earlier, we talked about JEA raising rates. That ties somewhat into this next headline, as the Jacksonville City Council is considering a measure to put a proposed half-cent sales tax increase on the ballot this fall to pay for local school repairs and improvements. Now, this would be a special election in November, and the referendum for schools would be the only item on the ballot. David, as we talked about earlier, one reason why our Duval County school system struggles so much financially is that there are several reasons why. They don't get anything from the utility, the biggest taxpayer in the county. They don't get any impact fees from developers to pay for building maintenance. We're one of the only counties in Florida that doesn't have that set up. And they weren't allowed to place this tax referendum on the ballot independently due to an opinion that was issued from the city's top legal officer, the Office of General Counsel. They're having to go through the city council.
Yeah, the common denominator in all of those is that the school board on itself cannot do any of those things now. It's all up to City Hall, City Council, and the mayor to do any of that. And so that has hamstrung the city, the school board. And the other thing, like all school districts across the state, they've been limited by the state legislature in terms of their ability to raise taxes, which is basically what an elected school body should be able to do.
Yeah, right. So, this is an independently elected body, Stephanie, being, as David said, they're being hamstrung in their efforts to try to figure out how to raise, and it's an enormous amount of money, to shore up the oldest school buildings in the state of Florida, which are here in Duval.
So we saw the school board give overwhelming approval to putting this to a voter, up to a vote on a ballot. Mm-hmm. But again, now this has to get through the city council to even get on the ballot. I think one of the things from speaking with councilmen, one of the bigger concerns that we hear, surprisingly, and it may just be a shield for now, but it's not a possible new tax. It's they don't want to have a single issue election. They want something this substantial to not the city not to have to go through the expense of putting on an election in November just for this issue. Not sure what the turnout might look like. So I wouldn't be surprised if throughout the council debate now we see a substantial amount of input on whether this remains a single issue in November or whether this is something that potentially they change the date on to try to correspond with some other election matters.
Yeah, this is interesting too because Jess, I was talking with some folks down in Hillsborough County, and just last November, they approved something similar, another half-cent sales tax, but they also approved a one-cent sales tax to improve transportation. So, you know, the taxpayers went for both of them overwhelmingly. Mm-hmm. But the difference here, like Stephanie mentioned, is the fact that this will be a single-issue election, and that's what council members are saying that they object to. They don't want to put up with the expense of hosting a special election for this. Now, the district has said they will pay for the special election, but council members are still objecting, saying that's still a waste of taxpayers' money.
But is that really the reason why?
Well, we'll find out when they vote on it. If they're making that argument during their council arguments, because the district has done a pretty good job of, so far, of trying to educate the community on why this money is needed. They put together a pretty good website that's very informative on what information is there and why this is needed. They've been doing public meetings. They've been having discussions. And so convincing council members that this is something that needs to be done now versus later when we have in next November or during a primary.
And aren't they saying they're up against a tight time frame because of a change in state law that goes into effect in 2020?
Yeah, it's basically now or never to get this in. So and the city is, they're advancing all kinds of excuses. They just don't want to do it. This is part of a broader campaign to keep public schools underfunded and thus underperforming so that they can turn around and say, look, these public schools are failing. Let's divert taxpayer money to charter schools and voucher programs. Now they have state accomplices. Now that Tallahassee is trying to take over a school board. Watch this space. I mean, something is going to happen where Tallahassee is going to say Duval schools are not performing well, and then our elected school board is going to transition to an appointed school board by executive fiat. I mean, these are things that have all been proposed and to take away an accountable public school board and replace it with unaccountable and mostly for-profit exotic alternatives.
Well, you know what? I that has been brought up, but let me ask all of you to talk about that for a minute. The Charter Revision Commission, which is meeting now and is looking at potential revision, will meet, looking at potential revisions. Charles, you're involved in this.
Full disclosure.
You're on the commission.
I've been nominated.
Nominated. Looking at potential revisions to the city charter. There are a few folks nominated for this body that are in favor of more privatization of schools. And so the question has been asked, will the idea come before this body to change the city charter? It came up the last time they met, to change the city charter so that the Duval County School Board members are appointed, not elected.
Yeah.
It was discussed last time. It didn't get enacted.
So just in preparation, I've been sort of poring through all of the past information from 10 years ago and looking forward to participating, to be honest. And we'll see if that comes up. If it does, then, you know, I want to do my due diligence to help figure out what the take on it would be, what would be best for the community.
What's your instinct right now?
Well, my instinct right now would be I'd like to have maintained, because this is what I'm used to, right? An elected body to represent the community.
Not just because it's what you're used to, but because that's how you get accountability.
That's how you get accountability, yeah. So, but someone would have to make a compelling argument for me to do something different, when we recommend something different. And really, the honest thing about it is that, you know, 10 years ago, many recommendations were made. None were adopted, from what I recall.
That's right. They met, they talked, they debated, they discussed, they made a bunch of recommendations, none of which actually happened. So that kind of begs the question, why even have this charter review if nothing's going to change?
Because the charter says you're supposed
to. Yeah, you have to do it according to the charter.
And when you say something enough times, it takes on a momentum of its own and just kind of wears away at the structures and institutions.
Well, I'll say this, that, you know, Jacksonville is a, for this community, it's ever evolving, but yet it's still the same. I mean, you know, sometimes I think about some of the things that used to, what used to happen 10, 15, 30 years ago. And while Jacksonville's progressed in a lot of ways, many things are still the same. And, you know, I'd like to be on the end of some really progressive growth changes in the community. And if this is a way to do that, and we'll see. But I'm looking forward to it.
And Charles, when you talk about people having to make a compelling argument for you, I think that's really one of the central points when we're looking at this school board sales tax. Because in the early days when this passed the school board, it's inevitable, it's going in front of the city council. The city council members were telling me, well, they really have to make the case to me. But when you look at what the school board's been doing over the past several months, to your point, it has been establishing this website, holding community meetings, informing the community. So it'll be interesting to see how much more can be done and how receptive the council truly will be when that argument is put in front of them.
Yeah.
Well, and by the way, one of the reasons why the school board is pushing for this is because the schools are getting crowded. This is another note from the week. Jacksonville had the country's 7th largest population growth last year and the largest in Florida, according to the Census Bureau. Now, the estimates say the city of Jax gained more than 12,000 people over the last year. That raises our total population to nearly 904,000. Miami had the 2nd largest increase in the state of Florida. Giorgio is someone who used to live down there. We tend to think of Miami as a lot more crowded than this city, but the truth is within the city limits, we now have more people within the city proper and growing all the time. We're in the top 10. So a lot of people moving into this city, by the way, are coming from South Florida.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, folks are coming from all over the place. Size-wise, you got such a large city / county that it's still pretty thinly populated, but it's growing. So it's uneven. There are places that are way more densely packed, and therefore there's more pressure on those schools. Also, just the history of this corner of Florida being kind of the first to develop. So mm-hmm. you have older infrastructure, and that's the main reason for this.
I'm wondering if that's a net gain, because there's a significant amount of people moving out of Jacksonville into surrounding counties. And the 12,153 may not be representative of all the people who actually, you know, sort of move here.
Right.
You know,
right.
Because, you know, we know that the demographics are changing, and the population gain may not be reflective of that.
Well, speaking of St. John's County, it takes the starring role today in our look at the strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from the week. Here it is for you right now, only in Florida. And only in Florida does a man fleeing police call 911 to taunt them that he got away. This happened in St. John's County. Take a listen.
I want to know, so, like, I like, ran from a cop, like, 30 minutes to an hour ago. I was the guy over there off of Kings Estate. Like, what do we pay you guys for? Like, I've driven past 4 cops.
What do you mean you ran from a cop?
I mean, he turned his lights on me and got behind me, and as he was walking up to my door, I did a donut around him and left.
Okay. That's Nicholas Jones of St. John's County running from police and then laughing at them as he got away. But you know what? They linked his phone number with his identity and were able to arrest him thanks to that fateful phone call. Thank you, David, Giorgio, Charles, and Stephanie. Up next, a live in-studio performance from world-renowned cellist Dave Egger. Thanks, guys. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bad boys, bad boys. What you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you? Bad boys, bad boys. What you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you? You chuck it on that one. You chuck it on this one. Chuck it on your mother and you chuck it on your father. You chuck it on your brother and you chuck it on your sister. You chuck it on that one and you...
The First Coast Free Thought Society book group will discuss Going Ape by Brandon Haught, which chronicles Florida's battles over evolution, beginning at 11:30 Sunday, June 2nd at a diner on Phillips Highway. Details at firstcoastfreethoughtsociety.org.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Law Firm.
I'm Wayne Hogan. When crossing traffic lanes, be on the lookout for motorcyclists. for everyone's sake. The seconds you use to look might save a life.
Learn more at waynehogan.law.
I'm Ira Flatow. This week on Science Friday, we'll take a look at the Trump administration's latest attacks on climate change research with climate scientist Michael Mann. And then John Urschel talks about how he went from pro footballer to tackling graph theory and higher-level math. Spoiler, his mom was a key. That's all on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon at 3 here on 89.9 WJCT.
Given the demand for affordable housing in this economy, you would think condos would be booming. Nope.
Right now, about 96% of multifamily construction is built for rent. That compares to about an 80% historic share.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. What the condo market has been doing since the Great Recession, next time on Marketplace.
This evening at 6, here on 89.9 WJCT.
Chancellor Angela Merkel warns the world about dark forces rising in Europe. And the Fox Business Channel debates trade with Chinese state TV.
This is not the language of a trade partner, but the insults you might hurl at an enemy.
The Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A.
Today at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, world-renowned cellist Dave Eggers is returning to Jacksonville this weekend. He's going to perform at the Mosh in their Brian Gooding Planetarium, along with musical partner Chuck Palmer as Cellogram. And they'll be accompanied as well by acclaimed vocalist Valerie Gent. This is a truly unique concert event. It's called Music for Dinosaurs and Other Fantastic Beasts, coinciding with the Mosh's new dinosaur exhibit. We're so pleased right now to have both Dave Egger and Chuck Palmer here in studio with a preview of this amazing show. Hey, guys, good morning.
Good morning. How's it going?
It's going great. And thanks so much for being with us. And so exciting to have you here in town, Dave and Chuck. Tell us a little bit about the show and what people will get to experience.
Well, this is such a fun project because it's the first time ever we've been able to pair our music and Valerie Gent's music with a full planetarium dome show. So it's a completely immersive experience that's amazing for your entire family. And we are going to be exploring dinosaurs. We have an amazing scientist, Dr. Barry Albright, who's going to talk about both the dinosaur era and also his own research in the post-dinosaur mammal proliferation era. And it's going to be like very exciting. We have music for cello and electronics, some really beautiful songs, some familiar songs, and songs about dinosaurs that we have been carefully excavating from the catalog.
Songs about dinosurs. I didn't know there were songs about dinosaurs.
You'll find out if you come.
Well, and sure, to see a show in the planetarium with this beautiful music combined with the visual feast, what an incredible sensory experience people can enjoy this Saturday night at the Mosh. Meanwhile, we're so excited, a special treat right now, as we have a preview of this performance live right now here in studio. What are you guys going to play?
We're going to do a work of ours in two movements. It's called Hillbillies and Bach. And so I'll be playing the cajon drum, which is a box drum that originates from Peru, to play Bach on a box, along with
Excellent.
Dave's masterful cello.
Here they are, Dave Egger on cello, Chuck Palmer on drums. Thank you. Right. Oh, man. That was amazing.
Thank you so much.
Oh, you guys. Oh, incredible. That is just what a way to get into the weekend.
That was early in the morning for that.
I know, early in the morning.
I feel fully caffeinated.
Well, go see them at the Mosh tomorrow night, Saturday, June 1st, 7:30 p.m. Get your tickets at Eventbrite. It is truly going to be a musical treat. It's cellist Dave Egger and percussionist Chuck Palmer with Valerie Gent. Music for Dinosaurs and Other Fantastic Beasts at the Mosh. Have a great show, guys.
Thank you so much.
And that is our show. I just loved that performance. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Michelle Corum is our director. And if you have feedback about the show, we always want to hear it. Send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And make sure to tune in today at noon for the Florida Roundup. We'll spend the full hour today looking at the approval of 3 new toll roads for the state of Florida. What does that mean for the state's infrastructure and environmental concerns as well? Tune in at noon for that. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect. Have a great weekend. We'll be back Monday.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.